Hi, welcome to this week's program. I have been watching the ABC movie about Bernie Madoff this week, and it has brought back a surge of memories I thought I would share with you. The year was circa 2004 when I got a call from a client just dying to sign up with Madoff. My client had been talking with a friend who had already been in the Madoff Fund since its inception in the 60s and was arrogantly touting its many attributes. This friend had invested $2 to $3 million and also got many others to invest their money with Madoff. He thought he could convince Madoff to invest my client's money because he knew him personally and had an inside track. Rounding out the rest of the story, this friend had also involved the in-laws of my client's daughter, and those in-laws had invested all of their money plus their entire company's bankroll into the fund. So I had them both come in and bring the Madoff statements so I could take a look. The first batch of statements looked legitimate, like any other brokerage statement, but were missing some important details, so I asked if there were more. I was then handed a large bundle of printouts, which were printed from an old dot matrix printer. Many of you may remember them, some may not remember them, but those were the kinds of printers that had the type of paper with the holes on each side. And this printout contained all of the trades going back a number of years. So I thanked them, and over the following number of days, I studied it. And the information on these sheets raised a lot of questions. The first thing I noticed was that all of the trades were made at the middle of each month. Different dates of the month, but definitely clustered in the middle. Each trade contained a purchase of an index fund, which held the top 100 companies in the S&P 500. Alongside this purchase were purchases of puts and calls, which were there to either enhance the return or protect the money. But it didn't make sense. How could anyone know what particular day to buy and sell these investments to achieve a consistent monthly profit with an annual rate of return of 10%? There were only two explanations as far as I can see. The first explanation would have to mean that somehow Madoff knew when large institutions were actively in the market buying and selling. If Madoff placed his trades before placing theirs, he might be able to pull this off. Now, I knew Madoff's brokerage firm was a market maker, which is a firm that facilitates trading in a security and therefore does see the customer order flow. So bottom line, if he sees the order flow, he can get in front of it. There's only one problem with this. It's illegal. It's called front-running, and it's against the law for any broker to put his trades ahead of a customer's order. Big red flag. The other explanation would be that it was all a fraud. Well, I couldn't wrap my head around this. Madoff's name had been around since I could remember, and there was never any negative news about him that I was aware of. The thought of a Ponzi scheme crossed my mind, but I couldn't believe that. Needless to say, I counseled against putting money with Madoff, and that turned out to be one of the best things I had ever done. Saving a client from disaster is a wonderful thing. What happened to the friend? Well, the friend had believed that he was now worth $26 million, according to my client, and had received his original investment back through monthly dividends. Of course, that was other people's money, really. So he ended up with nothing. The in-laws were wiped out along with so many others. So it brings some further thoughts and takeaways from this Madoff tragedy. In 2009 or 10, I interviewed Larry Lamer. He's a terrific author in Palm Beach who had written about Palm Beach society, and he mentioned that in Palm Beach, the Jewish community was very philanthropic. The season was filled with galas and balls, all centered around fundraising for worthy causes. He described a scene of the table talk of the guests at one of these charity events. You know, there are 8 to 10 sitting around a round table discussing this or that, maybe politics or business or recent car purchases or whatever. But inevitably, the conversation turned to money, and some bragging would then ensue. One guy would say, you know, my hedge fund manager was up 28% last year. And not to be outdone, another would say, well, you know, my money manager was up 34% last year. And so this discussion proceeded around the table. It came to one guy who said, well, my hedge fund manager is very conservative. He doesn't make these big returns. He just makes about 10% each year, year in and year out. Well, guess who his money manager was? Bernie Madoff, of course. So not only were those in small communities of Palm Beach hurt, but investors from all over the world were damaged. The many charities which depended on the largesse of giving people were hurt too, not to mention the people to whom they served. Pension plans also suffered. For example, a pension fund covering about 800 police, firefighters, and other employees in the Connecticut town of Fairfield had about $40 million out of a whole fund of $290 million managed by Madoff. Banks, insurance companies, foundations, colleges, and even celebrities all lost millions upon millions of dollars. The lesson and the sinister brilliance of this particular Ponzi scheme is that the investment returns being touted were not outlandish. You know, it's easy to see through a scam of someone offering a 20% return guaranteed. Just compare it to a real guaranteed return like the 10-year U.S. Treasury. For example, today that yield is under 2%, and that is a guaranteed yield for the next 10 years. Is it possible that anyone can offer a high rate substantially over what is essentially the real guaranteed rate of return? And the fact that it's guaranteed suggests that there's no risk? But Bernie wasn't offering an outlandish rate. The rate was not outlandish, but the consistency was. You cannot earn a 10% return every year. Your return can have an average rate of 10% for sure, which means in some years you're up and some years you're down. You know, simply said, maybe one year you're up 15%, one year you're up 5%, so the average is 10%. But to do 10% every year is mathematically really impossible in the markets. Bernie's other sinister trick was to create an air of exclusivity for those who were invested. They were members of a special club restricted to a chosen few. Anyone who belonged felt special and gave status to those who pretended to know Madoff or have some special pull. It's probably best to remember the words of Groucho Marx when he said, "You know, I refuse to join any club that would have me as a member." I think we should all remember that. So goes this tragic saga of a man who destroyed the lives of so many, including his own family and closest friends, and he left behind a scorched earth which many will never fully recover. Bernie left no one untouched or unscathed who crossed his path. He is a true sociopath. This holiday season, I think you would agree we could all use a break. So I'm rerunning some of the favorite segments of our listeners and our staff that we've handpicked for your enjoyment. We here at the Steve Pomeranz Show are wishing you all a very merry and joyous holiday and a very, very prosperous new year. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. The Christmas shopping season is almost over, but if you're smart, there are a few purchases that should wait until the holiday is over. Andrea Brown joins the conversation from Kiplinger.com. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What are some of the items that should not be bought during the holidays?
Well, there are a couple of things that you shouldn't buy, and I think a big thing here is for consumers to know is that, you know, it's very easy to get overwhelmed during this time of year because there are a lot of holiday sales that run through Christmas, and retailers are really trying to entice shoppers to spend money with deals as much as 50 to 60% off on certain items. And what people need to know is that some of those same items will go on sale for even cheaper prices at another time of the year, specifically right after Christmas. So one of the big things that you want to hold off and wait until after the holidays to buy is bedding. You know, during the holidays, you may tend to have lots of guests and people staying with you at your home, and you might feel like, oh, I need to run out and get new sheets and pillowcases, you know, to accommodate for these visitors that I've had in my home. And you definitely want to wait to do that because most big box retailers such as Target and major department stores such as Macy's, they will have white or linen sales in January with items such as, like I mentioned, comforters, sheets, pillowcases, things of that nature on sale for as much as 50% off. And for anyone who regularly is buying bedding for like a queen or a king size bed, that's a huge saving.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm pretty much oblivious to anything regarding betting, but I knew about white sales.
Yeah, that's definitely a good thing to know about. Another thing that people want to consider holding off until after the holidays to get is gift cards. And I know, you know, if you're a last-minute shopper or you're a procrastinator and you wait to the very last minute to buy your gifts, you just might automatically assume, well, let me grab this gift card and let the person buy, you know, whatever they want for themselves.
I've done that.
But a lot of times, you know, people get these gift cards for Christmas, they don't want them, and they end up selling them online. And you can buy them on websites such as cardcash.com or cardpool.com. for up to 15% cheaper than the face value of the card.
Yeah, let me stop you right there because this was fascinating. So in a sense, you can buy cash at a 15% discount by just going to these websites because people get the cash cards. They don't really want to buy stuff with them. They just want the cash, so they'll go and sell them because you can't redeem them, can you?
No, you cannot. And especially if you get cards that are store specific.
Yeah.
You know, you definitely, if you give somebody a card, you know, to a store that they really don't shop at or they're really not interested in buying anything from that, this is a way for them to sell that card and get the cash back, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. and spend that money on whatever it is that they want.
Well, we're definitely going to be putting this up on our website. The websites are cardcash.com and cardpool.com, both of those one word. What else is best to wait for?
Exercise equipment, oddly enough. You know, I know a lot of people tend to set fitness goals for the new year, and they think they need to go out and, you know, buy these treadmills and these ellipticals during the holidays, you know, because there's sales going on, so I have to take advantage of these sales while they're happening. But that is definitely another item you want to wait until after the holidays to buy, specifically in January.
What kind of markdowns can you expect to get?
Up to 70% off on things such as treadmills, elliptical trainers, and stationary bikes. And if, you know, if you're familiar with kind of how much those things tend to cost,
that's a lot.
They're usually in, you know, the $500, $600, $700 range, and you can get them for less than half of that amount if you just wait a few weeks after Christmas to buy them.
Well, since they're going to sit in your bedroom and you're just going to put your clothes on them after a while anyway, maybe you can include them in your bedding purchases.
Yeah, you know, there's no reason to pay full price.
What else you got?
Also, there is, you know, Caribbean cruises for people who might think, you know, the holidays are a good time to travel. You know, when you book a cruise during the months of January, February, and March, that usually means that you're missing the big holiday crowds. Holiday crowds would usually tend to go starting around Thanksgiving throughout December. You know, by waiting until January, you'll be able to take advantage of lower fares during that time of year. Also, another good thing is Broadway tickets, oddly enough. If you're traveling to the New York City area during the holidays and you're considering, you know, seeing a show, you might want to wait. If you plan on being there through January in New York, there is this thing called Broadway Week, which starts on January 19th. And during this time, show patrons can buy two tickets for the price of one. So anyone who's been to a Broadway show and you want really good seats, you know, they can cost you a couple hundred dollars. So this is a very good deal.
Yeah, that was surprising to me because, you know, I decided to give my son two Broadway tickets. That's actually what he wanted. And now after, you know, reading your material and speaking with you, I realized, you know, telling him to wait until January because he can probably get a good deal. I guess it depends on the show.
Yeah, it depends on the show. Now, a good thing to keep in mind is that the shows that you'll be able to see during this Broadway week are going to be limited, so it may not necessarily be, you know, the big, hot shows that are out right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Hamilton, you're not going to get to.
Right, exactly. Right. You definitely will not be able to see Hamilton during Broadway week.
All right, so we talked about betting, we talked about cruises, Broadway tickets, gift cards. What are some of the other items that we should wait until the beginning of the year?
Furniture. A lot of furniture retailers have clearance sales immediately following Christmas, and that can be as much as 50% off. And a lot of stores will have clearance sales on some of their sample sale items and some of their items that have been there, you know, some of the previous collections throughout the year, some of their previous furniture collections throughout earlier in the year. And the reason why they do that is because they're trying to clear out all of their older inventory to make room for the newer inventory that they're having for the new year that usually is released around February.
You know, when you're buying gifts for Christmas, you want to be able to give them during the Christmas period, right? And that's one of the reasons that waiting until January is kind of hard. Of course, betting you can... Probably not giving bedding for Christmas.
Right. No, and you know, one thing that I will say for that, you know, if you have little kids, obviously, you know, you're not going to want to wait until the week following Christmas. But if you have adult children, you know, kids in college who won't necessarily you know, be offended or, you know, be bent out of shape about getting a gift a couple days after mm-hmm. Christmas. You know, these are definitely times of year for you to take advantage of significant discounts.
Well, what about items like jewelry? Is that affected by the seasonality that you spoke?
It definitely is. It definitely is. Jewelry is typically, it's in high demand during the holidays.
Sure.
But there are specific times of the year that are better to buy jewelry. And specifically, you want to wait until after Valentine's Day mm-hmm. to buy jewelry, because
right.
a lot of jewelry stores will have sales of 15 to 25% off on jewelry post-Valentine's Day. That's also a very popular engagement season, that type of thing. So you'll see prices drop significantly after Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
So definitely don't, if you can wait, you know, if you can hold off on, you know, giving those, you know, those diamond earrings or, you know, buying, you know, your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your husband or wife, you know, a piece of fine jewelry. If you can wait until then, you definitely should, because you'll definitely see a difference at the bottom line.
Well, there's a very old saying that you should buy straw hats in winter. Of course, nobody wears straw hats anymore, but way back when, that was like a summer item. And so you should buy them in winter. So what would be another category that you would want to buy when it's out of season?
Holiday decorations,
oh,
for sure.
Perfect, of course.
Holiday decorations, for sure. And almost immediately following Christmas, like December 26th, you will see prices drop by more than half on things such as ornaments, artificial trees, string lights.
Mm-hmm.
Prices could be slashed by as much as 70% on these types of items. So if you don't need to buy new holiday decorations, but you think you might need to get some new, you know, replenish your holiday decorations for the following year, wait until right after Christmas leading into January to stock up on all of those types of items for the next year.
What about winter apparel? I mean, it is still the winter in January. Does that go on sale?
Yeah, items such as, and what you're talking about here, you're talking about, you know, your winter coats,
yeah.
sweaters, boots, things of that nature, typically go on sale right at the end of December going into January, because stores are trying to get rid of all of their winter apparel, all of their cold weather clothing and items like that to make room for their spring inventory, which usually tends to hit stores mid-February.
I see. Okay, what about winter sports equipment?
That also is another item, things such as snowboards, ice skates, hockey gear will be marked down by as much as 20% starting in January. So if you don't need to buy winter sports equipment before Christmas or, you know, before December or, you know, right around the holiday gift-giving time, you definitely want to wait until January. Because some of those things, you know, if anybody with kids who are on, you know, these types of winter sports teams know that the equipment can get pretty expensive.
Yeah.
So if you can just wait until January, where you can see the cost difference, it's definitely worth the wait.
Talking with Andrea Brown, she is with Kiplinger.com, and we're talking about best items to buy right after Christmas. Don't forget to go to onthemoneyradio.org to join the conversation. Andrea, what about buying a car in January versus in December?
Well, when it comes to cars, most dealerships around New Year's Eve typically offer the best deals on their vehicles. And the reason why this is because they're more willing to negotiate on price, because again, this is another type of item where they're looking to clear out their older inventory to make room for the new year's models. So you can, that definitely would be a better time for you to go in there and try to haggle a dealer on getting a lower price on a new car.
But I guess if you hold off longer, when do you think the best season is to buy a car? Do you have any idea overall?
It usually is in the spring, starting in early to mid-April is usually the best time
mm-hmm.
to look for cars. It's around that time that, you know, you'll find dealers that tend to buy the most at auctions and things of that nature. So they're looking to, again, make room for the new inventory, get rid of the older inventory. And also they get manufacturer incentives. So they kind of are passing on those savings to you.
My guest, Andrea Brown from Kiplinger.com, talking about the best things to wait until after Christmas to buy and to join the conversation and to find out about some of the websites that we mentioned on the show. Don't forget to go to onthemoneyradio.org. Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. I'm going to categorize this in the how things work department. You know, I'm always incredibly curious about how businesses work and how they start. You know, recently I interviewed Lisa Schiff, an art advisor to Leonardo DiCaprio, and I, you know, was wondering how she developed an art advising business. And I've also interviewed, you know, quite a few along the way to find that out as well. Well, today I want to talk about the restaurant industry, how one gets started, what it takes. You know, how do you make it successful, especially with all the competition vying for your customer? And, you know, we know that restaurants are always popping up and they're always disappearing. So today I've invited a successful restaurateur to talk about it. He's been starting and running restaurants for, I guess, about 38 years. So let's meet him. His name is Barry Corin. Hey, Barry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve. Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about what restaurants you've been involved with and what they've achieved.
Well, you know, I came out of an era in the 70s and 80s where restaurants were just bubbling up, especially in New York City. And those were the eras that people were really becoming more aware of food and wine. And I had a recent trip after I got married in the early 80s and went to California and went to a place called Mustard's Grill. There I experienced fresh fish on a grill, and that's where my restaurant started, with my first restaurant being Doc's Oyster Bar and Seafood Grill. That's on 89th and Broadway.
Okay.
That started in 1985 and brought grilled fish to New York. And with that came a second Doc's, and my partners and I decided to sprout out. We also created and founded Carmine's New York City, which now has 2 locations. And then from there, my partners and I decided that there wasn't any place on the Upper West Side to have just a sandwich without going into an old-fashioned diner. And we opened up EJ's Luncheonette. And from there, we had 3 locations, one of which is active still on 73rd and 3rd in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Okay, well, I think we got a good sense of your experience. You know, Barry, this is not scientific, but it seems that the most amount of small businesses seem to be the restaurant business. You know, it seems anyone who believes they're a decent cook feels that they can run a successful restaurant. What's your take on that?
Well, you have to have the drive to do that. You have to be inspired by something in your life to do it as a vocation and to do it on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I think there are lots of people out there that are listening that knows a fantastic recipe that they'd love to give to their favorite restaurant to try because they know it'd be a success.
Yeah.
But to make it on that is just not enough. Mm-hmm. You have to cover all bases in the restaurant business. You know, it's so many businesses into one, and it runs basically on emotion sometimes. Mm-hmm. An investment, if you're dealing for a return on your dollar and you're investing in the market, you make that investment and you let it sit and you follow the trends every day. Here in the restaurant business, it's run on people mostly and on a daily basis. Wait staff that represents you and your goal, and to create that every day on a constant and a consistent level is very difficult.
Very difficult. It takes a lot of hours too, I've noticed, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You're working while everyone else is playing.
So that brings up this idea of, let's say, the gentleman restaurateur, someone who's been successful in business, man or woman, and they have this image, oh, I'll sit at the bar and I'll welcome my friends and I'll be, you know, kind of a big deal. Do you see that in your travels?
Oh, without a doubt. People that have capital to invest like to sometimes go on the more glamorous side of things. Mm-hmm. And it still takes, even with money, it takes more than just that to make a restaurant successful. People with unlimited budgets can build restaurants, but to actually make them work and be successful is another story.
Yeah. How much of restaurant making is having some kind of, you know, special twist? Like you said, you were the first fish restaurant, let's say, in New York City. You know, something that, you know, you could build a franchise on or some special twist. Is that important?
Yes, absolutely. What's happened in the business traditionally over the years is that the manager, owner of the restaurant would be the figurehead and walk the room and interact with the guests on a nightly basis.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the personality of the chef that runs a restaurant, especially the personality chefs with a Mario Batali or a Bobby Flay. Those are names that are sought out by real estate people and other entrepreneurs that would like to open up restaurants with their names on it. And those are the personalities now in the restaurant business more than just the owners who were years ago.
Right. All right, let's take it from the beginning. You said before that you start with an idea or an inspiration. Kind of take us through the process. Let's say that I do have this idea and it's for XYZ type of food. What's the beginning of this process? I want to go through step by step.
Well, if you have an idea and you have the inspiration to go into the restaurant business, I highly recommend that you perhaps find somebody that has that inspiration as well. An example being a partner. My success grew out of surrounding myself with the most talented people I could find at the time,
mm-hmm.
whether it was waitstaff people or people behind the line in the back of the kitchen, chefs and cooks. I think if you have a bench full of people around you coming into your idea and success, and you can surround yourself with those people, it gives you a better chance of success.
So let's say you've done that. You've got this great idea. You now have to kind of find a partner, surround yourself with talented people, people who know how to train the wait staff, who've run restaurants before. What about, you know, getting the real estate, getting the capital itself? I mean, that seems to me, in some ways, can be very difficult because some of these restaurants, you know, cost a lot to set up.
Right. Well, if you come from nowhere in the restaurant business and you're just looking to open up a restaurant and you're seeking capital, you have maybe you're in money already and there are people available to you.
Mm-hmm.
But suppose you're a person that's been in the restaurant business for many years and you have a resume of titles that you can offer somebody to invest in you as a vehicle for success.
Mm-hmm.
I came to somebody early on in my career that believed in me.
Okay.
I had the desire to go into the restaurant business. I certainly didn't have enough capital to open up our first restaurant. But this person who was a businessman, his name was Arthur Cutler, and he owned Murray's Sturgeon Shop on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He believed in me. I had been in the restaurant business for years,
mm-hmm.
and I had an idea, and we both enjoyed that idea very much.
Well, he was, you said Sturgeon, so he was in the fish business.
Yes, smoked fish and appetizing. Very famous shop on the Upper West Side.
You were opening up your fish restaurant at the time.
Yes, we opened up our first fish restaurant called Doc's Oyster Bar, and that was 89th and Broadway. On the west side of the street, right next to Murray's Sturgeon Shop.
Oh, it was right next to it. So he understood the business to a large degree.
Yes.
It wasn't as if he was coming in cold. Okay, let's talk about opening the door. What does it take? You know, you go to a restaurant and the training of the wait staff is all over the map.
Right.
You know, and I guess I eat out a lot, so I kind of notice these things. You notice the patterns of patter with the wait staff, how they tell you about what's on the menu, and so on and so forth, how long they leave you to yourself. And, you know, there's always this period of time when it's like just enough, but then it's too long. How do you train a wait staff properly? What does it really take?
Well, you train them to take into consideration all types of circumstances, whether it's a table that's engrossed in conversation and they don't want to be overbearing.
Mm-hmm.
If there's somebody in the party that wants to be recognized as the main person in the party that will be ordering the wine, perhaps.
I see.
But opening up the doors, getting back to the door, mm-hmm. my first impression of a restaurant is the cleanliness of the restaurant.
Okay.
And to talk about opening up the door, I always look at the door itself to see if it's been cleaned.
Mm.
If there's a dirty door, it may be other dirty things in the restaurant. So putting together the restaurant, opening it up, sanitation number one,
mm-hmm.
then you have everything else that goes with that. Your staff, your training of the staff, training them on food, training them on wine, training them on cleanliness, training them on what to wear, perhaps when they're going into their uniforms at work.
Mm-hmm.
I never liked long earrings on women. I didn't like pierced items on anyone's face
mm-hmm.
or earrings on men as well.
Mm-hmm.
you know, we kept it simple. We kept everything clean. We had our same cadence of servers giving specials at the table the same way all the time.
Yeah.
And people come back for that familiarity.
Yeah, it's consistency, I think, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. Consistency is really, really the most important thing.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we're really running out of time here, unfortunately. So what makes people come back the most? Is it the food? Is it the environment? Is it the wait staff? Is it all in one? What is that?
It's a chemical reaction when you walk into a restaurant. And, we eat with our eyes. When a plate comes to you and waiter puts it down in front of you, you say to yourself, even subconsciously, oh my, I like this plate. Or, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to look like.
Yeah.
Or perhaps, wow, I'm really, really impressed with the way this looks and I can't wait to eat it. And that's an impression you want to give people every single time they come into your restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the curtain opens every night, like a Broadway show
right.
is consistent every night. So should your wait staff and your product should be that
mm-hmm.
as well.
Okay. Well, there's an awful lot to talk about here, but we are out of time. My guest is Barry Corwin, a successful restaurateur. And thank you so much for joining us, Barry. Appreciate it.
Steve, thanks so much.
And don't forget to hear this discussion again, to read about it, to weigh in with your opinion. We love your opinions. And also to share it with your friends. And you know we love that too. Don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Hey, welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So there seems to be some misunderstanding about VA loans with regards to actually the brokers that are working with clients and sellers as well. Tell us about your experiences there.
Yeah, just recently I had an opportunity to work with a VA person that was eligible for the benefits. And basically what happens, Steve, is a VA loan is an opportunity for a veteran to purchase a home with no down payment money.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually get lower interest rates. So it's a very attractive program. The idea behind it was, from World War II, let the GI guys be able to afford a home, affordable mm-hmm. housing, et cetera.
Right.
So anyway, the program's still out there. It's a benefit for those that qualify for it. And what happens is you receive an offer from a veteran, and you'll see the contract that shows 100% finance.
Yeah.
And that's where everybody goes into, panic mode. No, they can't do that.
Well, also, these buyers who are putting zero down are competing against people who have a lot of cash. And so there's a difficulty for them to buy these homes.
Correct. And that's where the problem lies. Because honestly, I just went through this with someone. He's been shopping for 2 years, kept losing out to somebody else that had more money down. But I just want people to realize these loans, they're very solid loans, they're good loans. There's a misunderstanding that there's a lot of red tape that you have to jump through, and that's really not the case.
That wasn't the case?
Not anymore. Maybe it was years ago, but today, it's pretty straightforward. So if you do receive an offer from a veteran, and it's a good offer, don't be afraid to accept
it. Okay, well, that's
just
really good
make
advice.
Sure you're educated on it, but there's nothing that should freak anybody out.
Yeah. I'm glad that you brought it up, because these are areas of the marketplace that don't get really talked about all that much. But you're on the ground every single day, so you see all different kinds of transactions. And this is one that came to your attention that you brought it to my attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's very cool. All right, so let's go into some of your real estate survival guide stuff. I love this stuff.
Yeah.
And you put down some ideas about the first year mistakes that new owners make. Take us through that.
When you buy a house, the first thing, you've now closed on your house and you want to put in new carpet, paint, do some maybe contracting work. And so you'll go out and get a couple of bids from different people. But, the lowest bid is not always the best bid. So my advice would be to make sure you're comparing all facets of the bids to make sure that, the quality of the windows are all the same.
Yeah.
So know what you're getting into. Just shop and make sure you understand what the three bids are.
I think that's a good lesson financially in life for really anything. It's nice to have the lowest bid, but you may get shoddy materials. Let's say you're buying paint.
Right.
So they can use the cheapest paint. And if you're not really watching and comparing apples to apples all along the way, then you're really going to get what you pay for.
That's right. You're going to be painting the house, you know,
more frequently.
So you're going to cost.
Years, right.
So sometimes buying a better quality paint makes more sense. You know, the other crazy thing is you have now insurance, and some people believe, oh, wow, I need to file a claim because something happened to the house.
Yeah.
Be aware that submitting small insurance claims is not a good idea, especially if it's even less than your deductible, because you're now creating yourself a history. And so later when you go to buy a house, try to get insurance, I don't know, you're going to be dinged for all of this.
Okay, wow. I never really thought of that.
Yeah, so
I mean, just be aware. I thought you were going to say that they were going to raise your premium.
Well, I don't know if they do that or not, but I just know that it's not a good idea to have a bunch of claims.
Ah, interesting.
So just understand.
That's all the insurance companies kind of share that information to a degree, I guess.
You know, I'm not in that industry, but I know that it's just not a good idea
to
put in a bunch of claims for insurance. So just be aware that if something costs less than the cost of your deductible, just eat it. Don't notify your insurance company.
And, you know, my advice is get the bigger deductible. You know, the $1,000 deductible. Not the $250, not the $500, because you, like you said, you don't want to really do the petty stuff.
Right.
And home insurance is for the big events. You know, you have a major event.
The house burns.
Something terrible, right? So yes, you'll have to pay $1,000, but your premiums will be lower and the chances of those things happening are fairly remote. So you'll save money in the long run.
You know, and a third item is failing to consider the return on investment for home remodeling. So, you know, here you just purchased a new house and you want to do things to it. Make sure it makes sense that you're putting this money into the house. For example, you buy a house, a $300,000 house, and you want to add, I don't know, 300 square feet to it, and it would make it a $500,000 house, but the neighborhood is a $300,000 neighborhood. Probably not a good idea. So, you know, make sure you understand what your rate of return is going to be when you're considering remodeling projects.
We're always talking about this. Where you get your most money back. And I don't really remember exactly, but I think kitchens
and bathrooms, they're high rate returns.
Yeah, yeah. So you walk into a house and it's got a kitchen that needs remodeling, that's going to depress the house price.
Right. I mean, there's always other factors, but yes.
I'm being very simplistic,
right.
But for this discussion, but you come in and you have a brand new upgraded kitchen, you know, you're going to get the price that you're listing the house for. You can probably list it for a decent amount.
Right. You'll definitely yield more from an updated kitchen.
Okay.
And then tossing out your receipts. It's important to save all your, you know, big ticket item receipts because of tax consequences.
Uh-huh.
And you may sell your house 20 years from now, but you could run yourself into a capital gains situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And to lower your capital gains, you need to have your receipts to prove that you put X amount of dollars into the house.
Yeah. So for a single person, you get a $250,000 exclusion when you sell. So the first $250,000 of capital gains, you pay no taxes on. But let's say, you know, it appreciates by 500, so then you're going to have to pay taxes on the excess 250. Now, if you've put money into the house and you've got your receipts to prove it, then you add what you spent to the cost of your house, so that's going to lower the capital gains.
That's right. So save those receipts. Don't
right.
toss them.
Okay. And finally.
And then, you know, ignoring seemingly minor items on the inspection report, just make sure when you purchase the house, you go through your inspection report and understand what one thing could lead to.
Very good. Well, those were some wonderful tips, and I want to thank you. And I know you can't tell as a listener, but Terry is actually in the studio with us today. She just moved very close to our studio, so I welcome her. This is a second episode that we've done, and maybe we're going to do more like this.
Yeah, very good. Enjoyed it.
Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
This holiday season, I think you would agree we could all use a break. So I'm rerunning some of the favorite segments of our listeners and our staff that we've handpicked for your enjoyment. We here at the Steve Pomeranz Show are wishing you all a very merry and joyous holiday and a very, very prosperous new year. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Cass Sunstein is the founder and director of the program on behavioral economics and public policy at Harvard. Now, this is my first time meeting him, but his many books include one of my favorites, the bestseller Nudge, written with Richard Thaler, whom I've heard speak about the book in Chicago a few years ago. Hi, Cass. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Steve. Great to be on.
So, Cass, sit back for a second and allow me to set the scene. Imagine the most powerful country in the world and a set of smaller countries unified in the effort to bring peace and prosperity to the world have been challenged by rebellious forces and extremists. And in the meantime, within these same countries, forces of change are moving toward a direction of isolation and division. What do you think I'm describing? Is this Brexit? Or is this a description of your new book, The World According to Star Wars?
Well, it's recognizably connected with Star Wars. How this involves developments in Europe is a more complicated question. So my initial answer is, sounds like Star Wars, the prequels.
Okay. Well, you know, I do think that there are some analogies to your book and to what's going on today. But first of all, let me just ask you, you write so many serious books. What prompted you to write a book relating to Star Wars themes?
It was basically my little boy, now 7 years old, who at age five got improbably obsessed with the Star Wars movies for at least 6 weeks. And when he was focused on the Star Wars movies, I got really curious about why these movies became the defining saga of our time. Why did they earn $30 billion? Why are children all over the world really interested in Star Wars? And also I got keenly interested in how George Lucas, the kind of mastermind of the saga, how did he come up with this stuff? And it turns out that there are a ton of surprises and false starts and unanticipated bursts of imagination, both in the success of Star Wars, which was not expected, and in the genesis of Star Wars. So when I saw all that, it connected with things in business, as your opening question suggests, in politics, definitely in law, in economic developments. That seemed to fall into place. I was hooked.
Well, the saga of Star Wars was very much based or helped with Joseph Campbell's 1949 book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And Joseph Campbell was an important influence on Lucas. So I'd like you to take a moment to describe George Lucas's universe.
Well, I think you've got the kind of son, so to speak, of the S-U-N of Lucas's universe, which is the monomyth, which is an idea that many religions and cultures have as cultural myths, have a tale of a hero's journey, where there's someone who is kind of isolated with a family and at home, who's called to some very big adventure, who initially declines, who then says yes, who finds a mentor, who is challenged and maybe whose life is at risk, who surmounts the challenge, who lives, and then eventually returns home, at least in some way. And that monomyth, which you can see in Christianity and Judaism and Islam in various forms, is the kind of core of the tale of Star Wars. So George Lucas told that tale both about Luke and about Anakin Skywalker, and in some ways about Leia Skywalker also, the heroine's journey. And that's kind of what Lucas was about, but he gave it some very original twists having to do with self-government and freedom in that sense, and also freedom of choice at the individual level.
Right. I want to get into that, particularly in today's world. So these themes, I guess him tapping into this age-old theme is one of the great reasons for the success. But when you think about Star Wars and you think about the Empire and you think about the rebels and, you know, one side's good is another side's evil and vice versa, it's a little bit more complicated than just purely good and evil. But talking about the shifting that's going on in American society today, now we're not really talking about good or evil, but we're talking about the status quo being upset by, in a sense, rebellious forces. Take us through some of the parallels between Star Wars and what's going on in American society today.
Well, there's a tale in Star Wars about an authoritarian government that gets dismantled by freedom-loving rebels. There's also a tale in Star Wars about a republic that is not functioning so great, that gets undermined from within by authoritarian forces. And I think the first tale of the triumph of republics is best understood as parallel to the American Revolution. I don't think that's what Lucas had in mind, but I think that's the closest parallel.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the disintegration of a self-governing society and its kind of usurpation by an authoritarian government, the best parallel is Nazi Germany, and that George Lucas did have in mind, at least as one of the historical models. So the United States now is, in my view, an extremely well-functioning republic for all of its challenges by historical standards. It's stable, robust, and massively successful, notwithstanding the economic and, let's call them, old-style Republican challenges that is making democracy work well. So I wouldn't say that we're at risk of an Emperor Palpatine, and I wouldn't say that we are now an empire that's being rebelled against by people who don't like it.
So you don't see us at that point then, where there's an analogy with these. But there is a force of change taking place in American society where the status quo, I think in some way, seems to have become very solidified and maybe to a degree inflexible, and many individuals seem to be unhappy with how the economy is treating them, and therefore you're starting to see a change take place. Is this just imagined, or do you see this as something that's actually happening?
You raise a great point. So the forces of change have two faces right now, and one is Donald Trump and the other is Bernie Sanders, and they're very, very different. So in terms of your point, you know, to kind of underline where I think you're onto something, is that in any period in which a nation's legislative branch is paralyzed by an inability to reach a consensus, there is an attraction to many people in the idea of a strong man who will set things right.
Yeah.
Now, the strong man could be a woman, but in our case, I think some of Trump's appeal, whether you like him or not, is that he is seen as possibly, you know, steering things on a course, at least, when previously we've been kind of buffeted about on the ocean. And that you can see in Europe now, and it's certainly something that the Star Wars saga depicts in a very negative sense. I'm not a Trump supporter by any means, so I don't think that this is a good model for the United States, but there's no question that there is appeal, and there's a real parallel there with a psychological and political depiction in Star Wars that we are seeing. Now, the Bernie Sanders idea isn't about a strong man. It's about unjust inequality. And what Sanders is depicting is not a paralyzed legislature so much as a government which is, in his view, run by a self-interested elite, namely wealthy people and banks. Now, I'd say two things about that. First, and less important, I just don't share that view, though, you know, I admire Sanders' moral commitment. I don't think he has America right. But much more important for purposes of the present discussion, that particular dynamic is not the dynamic depicted in Star Wars. The Star Wars does depict a different kind of rebellion. What Star Wars depicts is something like the appeal and false authority of the strong man.
My guest is Cass Sunstein. He's the founder and director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy at Harvard, and he has co-written the book Nudge with Richard Thaler, a very well-regarded book. And his new book is The World According to Star Wars and That Hero's Journey and This Understanding of How This Myth Plays Out Generation After Generation. or really civilization after civilization. We're trying to get some context here. Cass, you specialize in behavioral economics, and you have written that you've shown that if people describe options in a certain way, you can get people to do and even see what you want. You get a chance to lead them, I guess, in a positive sense, and perhaps manipulate them in a negative sense. And you don't have to really be a futurist to see this. It's kind of a common human condition. Can you describe that to us a little bit?
Okay, so the way I'd phrase it is that human beings are not computers, they are not algorithms, that we are subject to predictable biases, that how problems are described and what the starting point is can often influence outcomes. So if you're defaulted into a system where you have a double-sided printer, you're going to be saving a lot of paper. If you're defaulted into a single-sided printer, you're going to be using a lot of paper. If you're defaulted into a savings plan of a certain kind, chances are you're going to stick with it. Most people do. If you have to sign up, the likelihood is that at least a significant number of people won't. People's risk judgments are often a product of what readily comes to mind. So if you hear about people getting Ebola, you might be really scared, even if the statistical risk is really low. So we have about 40 years now of really terrific research on how people's thinking departs from standard rational models. And this is true basically of all of us if we're human. Now, if you have a GPS, it can counteract some of your biases by just telling you this is the right direction to go if you want to get to your preferred destination fast. If you have a problem described as one in which if you use an energy conservation approach, you'll save $100 a year. That tends to be less effective than if you don't use it, you'll lose $100 a year. So people are very unhappy with the idea of losses, and just describing something as a loss can trigger their attention. So what we're dealing here now in response to your question is first, how people are not perfectly rational. They're not irrational, but they are not perfectly rational. And second, how either a public-spirited or a self-interested outsider or a family member can oppress people in the directions that may be in the interest of the person or may be in the interest of the person who's doing the nudging, let's say.
So you may have two people with the same exact ideas, and one of them perhaps is using fear as a mode for communication. And since a human being is wired to react more to fear than to pleasure, that person may be able to manipulate us more or have more power over us.
Completely. So if people are scared of, let's say, losing money in the stock market, that can really get them to put the money under their pillow. Whereas if they're hopeful of making money in the stock market, that's good, but it's less good than the fear of losing money is bad for most people. So losses, I'd say, are very stirring to the human brain, more so than gains are stirring to the human brain. This is actually true not just of human beings, it's true of a wide range of mammals. And there may be an evolutionary reason for this, that losses can get us going. And it is true that people can be manipulated in this way, and politicians sometimes do that. And they can also be helped in this way by people who are, you know, just trying to help people make wiser choices.
Very interesting. You know, you mentioned earlier that the Star Wars saga has some elements to it that inform us about how the law works. And recently we've seen some landmark decisions from the Supreme Court. And I was wondering where the analogy is with Star Wars and how the Supreme Court makes decisions.
Yes, great. So in Star Wars, there are episodes. We now have 7. And each episode has to be faithful to the one that came before, in the sense that it can't ignore it and just conclude that what happened there was somebody's dream. It has to respect it But it also has to, and we're talking about Star Wars now, make the unfolding narrative good rather than idiotic or farcical. So that's the goal in creation of new episodes of Star Wars. When it works, the goal is fulfilled. The Supreme Court is doing something actually quite analogous. So if the court is deciding an issue involving affirmative action or the power of the president or abortion, it basically has to respect the prior episodes. In extraordinary circumstances, you can overrule them, but those are really extraordinary. It has to respect them, but also make what the justices think is good sense out of them. And the contest within the court and the country really is often, has the court respected prior episodes, and has it made sense rather than nonsense out of them? So American law actually has I am your father moments, so to speak, as in The Empire Strikes Back, where the law takes a shift that makes you see everything in a new light. And when it's working well, people have an immediate reaction of, you're kidding, or, oh my God, but quickly followed by a reaction of course, that's right. And that's what happened with eliminating school segregation, though it wasn't universal, that's right. It took a few decades. With same-sex marriage, I think we're seeing something pretty similar.
The book, The World According to Star Wars, the author Cass Sunstein, founder and director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy at Harvard, and also co-author of the bestseller Nudge with Richard Thaler. Cass, so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. A great pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thanks, Steve.
You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on The Steve Pomeranz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomeranz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomeranz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.